Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Music of Farouz. It's a selection of our guest on Sunday night. As the Arab Spring bloomed across the Middle East, it passed almost without trace across the one continuing fissure, the question of Palestine. Yet over the last few years, amidst mutual recriminations between Hamas and Fatah and continuing dissolution over corruption in the remnants of the old PLO Arafat secularists, coherence was found in one figure. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti ran second in the 2005 Palestinian presidential elections on a platform of moderate peace negotiations and anti-corruption. Among many young people of the West Bank, he's seen as a figure of hope in a world of disillusion and disappointment. He put himself on the front line and was injured several times in clashes with Israeli forces. In 2009, he was honoured by France with the Legion of Honour. He's presently in Australia to present the Edward Said Memorial Lecture and as a guest of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Mustafa Barghouti, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For many of us looking at the Palestinian-Israeli question, the first thing that emerges at a very simple level, the question is, why can't Palestinians get their act together?
Well, actually, they did many times. And in my opinion, the question should be rephrased. The question should be probably, how come the Palestinians, after all what they've been exposed to, after all this long struggle, after the longest occupation in modern history, which lasted for 46 years, and the dispossession of more than 70% of Palestinians since 64 years, how come they are still so resilient and capable of maintaining their cause? Of course, we have many internal problems, and we have a lot to do, especially on the issue of bringing in or bringing back our internal democratic system and getting over this terrible internal division. But the most important thing that I would like your audience to know is that regardless of all the suffering and difficulties and sacrifices and wars that were conducted against us, we are there, and we're resilient, and we are hopeful and full of optimism that one day we will also be free like everybody else.
Well, let's talk about a couple of elements in that freedom. The one thing that many people will notice changed over the last 30 years is the increasing polarization on both sides, both from the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, and the growing polarization of the religious views. Now, this dispute initially was led by secularist forces, the old PLO. It comes from a secular tradition. Here today we see religion as being a player, but a player in most people's views in quite a negative way.
Well, in this case, religion is not the cause of the problem. I think this is more of a case of a country that has been under colonial occupation rule of another, and about one side oppressing and persecuting the other. And it's a struggle for freedom. It's not a religious fight between Muslims and Jewish people. Many, many people in Australia probably and in the world forget the fact that there are many Palestinian Christians, as a matter of fact, and Christians are also persecuted, not just Muslims. This is not a religious issue. It's a national issue. But as usual, in some cases, religion is abused. The most important thing to remember here is that when we speak about Palestinian right for freedom and independence and ending occupation, it's not anything against Jewish people or Israeli people. On the contrary, I feel I struggle not only for the freedom of Palestinians, but for the freedom of Israelis themselves, because as long as we are suffering from a system of oppression and apartheid, the Israelis themselves will not be free. So it's not Palestinians against Israelis. It's the good people among Palestinians and Israelis struggling against a system of oppression that is threatening the very future of everybody.
I take your point, but if we continue, say, the apartheid analogy, there was a significant ideological component reinforced by religion in apartheid. It happened to be Christianity in the case of South Africa. But here in the Middle East, you have tensions between, say, Hamas and Fatah, which might be political, but they are used by religion ideologically. Similarly, on the Israeli side, there is a more conservative form of Judaism that has pushed into the debate against the old secular tradition. Now, irrespective of the core issue that has to be solved, those religious dimensions are pulling it apart. They're making it more difficult rather than less difficult. And you have to take that seriously, surely.
Absolutely. But as we all know, religion is something that is there to help people. When religion is practiced in the right way, it brings people together. It brings love and peace and harmony between people. And when it is abused, then it can lead to hatred and lead to conflicts and lead to problems. And definitely, I totally agree with you. There are people among Palestinians and among Israelis who are trying to abuse religion to take things to the extreme side and to encourage violence and encourage confrontation. That should not be accepted, and we should differentiate between the right approach and the wrong approach in this regard. But religion, like everything else, it could be used for the good cause or it could be abused.
You're confident that those religious divisions, first on the Palestinian side, can be overcome?
No, they can be overcome easily, because I don't think Hamas owns Islamic religion. It's what we call political Islam. But it's quite important to understand that one of the reasons why political Islam became strong in a country like Egypt or in Libya or in other countries is mainly because the autocratic, oppressive, secular regimes in these countries have oppressed so severely the democratic forces in their own country, especially the democratic secular forces. And by doing so, they closed the space for political activity, for pluralism, for opposition, and for democratic reform. And by closing that space, by destroying civil society or limiting civil society, the only way to show opposition or for people who were opposed to hide was the mosques. And religion was used as the only possible way of building an opposition. That's why when elections took place in Egypt, the Muslim brother candidate won. That's why Hamas got a majority in one elections we had, mainly because the democratic forces were not encouraged and supported. This is one of the prices of Western governments, to be frank with you, supporting or tolerating oppressive regimes in the Middle East. But at the end of the day, neither Hamas nor Muslim Brothers nor any other political Islamic party owns the religion. Religion belongs to everybody.
It's also the case that the old democratic secularist, the leftist democratic secularist parties, fell victim to internal corruption, and the religious extremists managed to get hold because they were seen as at least free of corruption and delivered with some integrity to the people.
Yeah, but what do you mean by corruption? Corruption is not only financial corruption. In the case of Palestine, the main form of corruption today is the political corruption, which is nepotism and clientelism. That was the problem with the regime before. And to the great surprise of many people, when Hamas took over, they practiced the same things, nepotism and clientelism. They would appoint only their own people, only their members of their party. And of course, I understand when you are elected in parliament, you would have some political appointees. That's natural. But you don't start appointing teachers and engineers and doctors according to their political orientation. That's what Fatah did in the past in the Palestine. And that's what Hamas is doing today. That's why people feel they need a third alternative approach, which we represent, where we say we should not allow this nepotism and clientelism to continue. You cannot substitute one party rule with another one party rule. What we need is a pluralistic system, and we have to separate political representation from running the civil structures. Anybody that wants to be appointed in the state apparatus has to be appointed on the basis of merit and equal opportunity. And that's the meaning of democratic reform that we are calling for. That's the kind of reform that the whole Arab world needs today.
That sort of political maturity, which you aspire to is the necessary basis for any civil society, that is the rule of law and a non-party preferential system. Yet it seems that that sort of political maturity is very difficult to attain, particularly in societies which have been subject to the sorts of pressures that the Palestinians have been subject to for, as you say, two generations now.
I do agree with that. And one main problem we face is external interventions by other countries, by donors, for instance, who prefer this party or another. We had this very interesting discussion in Sydney in the Opera House about the rogue states. And I suggested that there should be a new title for maybe next round, which is about confused states. And let me clarify that. Many Western governments, for instance, support democracy and speak about democracy. But when it comes to democratic practice, they pick and choose. They would say, we would like to have elections in this country or that country. But they would like to see a particular result. And if that result doesn't happen, then they take a stand against the results of democratic elections. That's unacceptable. It reminds me with a joke of a dictator that went hunting with his aide. And he told his aide, look here, we're going to hunt and we'll have equal share. And they hunted a rabbit and a lion. And at the end of the day, he turned to his aide and said, look, we're Democrats here. If you want the rabbit, take the rabbit. If you want the lion, take the rabbit. There is a lot to learn from that. And that's why I say it's unacceptable for a democracy, for instance, like Australia or France or Britain, to pick and choose and decide this is the governor we want to support. This is the person we want to give support and money for, and we would accept nepotism and clientelism. This is unacceptable. People should be allowed to have their experience, to build their own democracy. And tolerance has to be there for their choices, because I believe in people. I believe in humanity. I believe in the capability of people to learn, even when they make mistakes. They should be allowed sometimes to make mistakes so that they can make the right choice afterwards.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you, and our guest is Dr. Mustafa Bourgouti, Palestinian leader who is in Australia for the Edward Said Lectures and Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Mustafa Bourgouti, let's have another piece of music now. في شي عم بيصير. Music selected by our guest on Sunday Night, Dr. Mustafa Bourgouti, who is in Australia for the Edward Said Lecture and the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. Mustafa Bourgouti, let's talk about how you have come to the position you have. You come from an old Palestinian family. You have relatives engaged in the struggle over many years. But let's talk about yourself. You chose a career initially as a physician. You trained as a doctor. You worked as a doctor in saving lives. Were you initially committed to politics? Did you see both things as being held in tandem, or did you decide, no, I need to have a medical career, and the politics came later?
Well, yes and no, actually, because in Palestine, even when you are a very young student, you cannot avoid politics. And I was active in the student movement very early. And I think early on, probably what directed my political orientation was this strong belief in social justice. And I saw the Palestinian problem from the perspective of severe injustice, and not as a national issue, not as a national conflict between two people or two nations, but as an issue of injustice. For me, the oppression of Palestinians is not different from the oppression of women in a society that does not respect women. That's how I increasingly became involved in the Palestinian struggle. But I thought of medicine for two reasons. First of all, I loved the profession. I loved, and I still do love, the practice of medicine, because it's so tangible and so specific, and you can really help people at times when they are having big difficulties. But at the same time, I saw medicine as a profession that I could practice regardless of any conditions around me. Even if you are in prison, you can still practice medicine and nobody can stop you from doing that. But I learned in my experience that if you do individual medical practice, you can help a certain number of people, but you don't solve the health problem. One of my best experiences in life has been the participation in the creation of Palestinian Medical Relief Movement and Medical Relief Society, which is a voluntary health movement to get out and help people in underprivileged and poor areas. And this has become one of the most interesting organizations in Palestine, serving and helping more than 1.5 million people today every year. So we founded the health movement, the medical relief, to be able to influence health policies. And then I discovered also that it's not enough. You need to also get involved in politics to influence the policies in a real way. And maybe this gradual kind of movement led me to becoming more involved in trying to reform the whole system, not only for the sake of sick people or the sake of proper health care for everybody, but for the sake of bringing freedom, democracy, and social justice.
Dr. Baghoudi, it must be that in this path towards political engagement, your medical career has helped in that you seem to feel essential that you keep in touch with the grassroots. I guess that's part of the doctor-patient thing. And you've been noticed by young Palestinians in particular as being somebody who's prepared to stand on the front line with them. Indeed, you've been yourself injured in a number of clashes.
That's true. That's true. And I think any person who wants to be in a position of leadership, especially political leadership, has the responsibility of being very present at the grassroots level. This is very essential to understand the issues and the people. You see, there is this type of leaders who would sit in their offices, give orders to people, even sacrifice other people's children, implementing their orders, and they would feel safe away from. This is something that Palestinians hate, and the younger generation today measures each leader by the amount of involvement and true presence at the grassroots level. And in our nonviolent resistance, which is growing today, we have to be there and we have to be with the people. I personally cannot even tolerate the idea of subjecting anybody to a risk that I would not myself be subjected to.
And why is it that the path of nonviolence as a political option appeals so strongly to you? What philosophical understanding do you bring that leads you to think that this is a practical, real way to deal with the political situation today?
There are two reasons. One is I personally hate violence. I see the victims of violence and try to help them and heal them. And as in one confrontation with some Israeli soldiers, when they were trying to threaten me, I told them, you shoot people, you kill people, I treat people. We can't be on equitable basis here. So in principle, I don't know why, but I have this internal, very strong gut feeling against any form of violence. And I think using violence as a form of solving problems is inhuman, uncivilized, but that's one side. The other side of it is political, and I've studied our history. I know that nonviolence is the most effective way of achieving our goal for two reasons. One is because there is this very wrong image about Palestinians, as if we are terrorists or violent people and so on, and we cannot win our struggle without maintaining the moral integrity for this struggle. And that's why I think we have to fight very strong against wrong impressions about Palestinians. And in this case, nonviolent approach is the best way of presenting the right image about Palestinian struggle. But there is another reason, which is that Israeli authority, and I mean by that this Israeli government, which is extreme, which is full of illegal colonial settlers, which is pushing always for confrontation, they have built Israel on the basis of the belief that military power is the only way to survive. And Israel now has probably one of the most powerful armies in the world. They have 300 nuclear heads. They have chemical weapons, but nobody talks about that. And I think they like to have us engage in violence because this is the game they know, and this is the game they can win. I also must say that I've been influenced very much by the ideas and practices of people like Gandhi, and Martin Luther King, and also Nelson Mandela. And by the way, Nelson Mandela also practiced military struggle in the beginning of his life. And then he realized that nonviolent resistance is the most powerful way. And that's how South Africa gained its independence eventually.
There were a number of Israeli voices in previous political regimes in Israel who would resonate with what you're saying. The current regime does not, and indeed in Israel you seem to be seeing a hardening of attitudes over recent years rather than a softening, particularly under external threat, whether it's well-perceived or ill-perceived from Iran and other forces. So for the Israelis too, it's not simply a matter of the Palestinians, it's a matter of where they see themselves geopolitically. Who are you dealing with? Who do you hope to deal with on the Israeli side?
With the people. I think there are many wonderful people. Many of them come and participate with us in our demonstrations, and they are subjected to the same risks we are subjected to, and I really respect these people. But unfortunately, they are still a small minority. But let me tell you, Israel is turning to extremism not because there is a serious external threat to its presence. We all know that Israel is so powerful, nobody can threaten Israel, neither Iran nor anybody else. The Israeli society is turning to extremism and racism and creating a system of apartheid that is much worse than what prevailed in a place like South Africa, mainly because, unfortunately, the Israeli society feels that occupation is profitable. Just in the area of Bethlehem, the amount of land they confiscated, and that's not the biggest region in the West Bank, the amount of land they confiscated in Bethlehem is worth $30 billion. And they're making benefits from that. So they're making benefits by exploiting 90% of our water resources. They're exploiting Palestinian workers who work mostly without any rights. So I think the Israeli society, unfortunately, tend to extremism because this occupation has been profitable and costly. And what we do now, our strategy of nonviolence and mobilizing the world support, including the possibility of boycott and divestment sanctions against the Israeli policies and against settlements, is a way of making occupation costly. And that's when I hope the Israeli society will wake up and understand that they cannot continue what they do.
This is a long-term vision. Do you see this in a time frame, or do you just say, this is what we do and we just keep on?
I wish that we can end this situation as soon as possible for many reasons. But one of them is that I don't want my daughter or other Palestinian children or Israeli children to go through the same problems we went through all our life. I lived all my adult life under military occupation, under oppression. And I don't wish that for anybody, especially for our children. And that's why we try to find shortcuts to a quick solution, like two-state solution. But I know that what happened in India eventually will happen in Palestine. I know what happened in South Africa eventually will happen in Palestine. We are no different from others. And the cause of justice will eventually prevail. But, of course, we will do everything we can to shorten this hard way and achieve a result as soon as possible.
Dr. Mustafa Bouguti, we've run out of time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you today. Mustafa Bouguti, General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thank you so much. And let me say, I'm so impressed about the amount of knowledge and support the Australian people have for Palestine today. This is a great and big and wonderful change that is very encouraging. But also, I want you to know how much your country is beautiful and peaceful. You have something that we aspire for, peace. And sometimes maybe people don't see it till they lose it or till it is threatened. I hope you do appreciate how wonderful it is to have such a peaceful situation like the one you have in Australia.
Mustafa Bouguti, let's finish with another piece of music. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.